Substance. Stories about the stuff that shapes our world.
I was never really interested in academia. There has to be a reason why you want to do something, and that is either that you're trying to make a better product for the customer, or in the end that you're making something which is financially interesting for an organization. And I think that that context was always as a backdrop for me during my master's degree, during my PhD. It always needs to be able to make sense that you would do something that in the end is makes the world better than where it is right now.
Substance. I'm Joe Hansen, and this is Substance, a podcast about the discoveries and innovations in chemistry and beyond, helping us build a sustainable society for the future. In short, we tell stories about stuff that shapes our world. And in this episode, our topic is sulfur. Why should you care about sulfur? You might remember sulfur from chemistry class, a yellow rock that emits a pretty pungent smell when you burn it. But sulfur is so much more than just the main ingredient in stink bombs. It's secretly one of the most important substances that we use. Far more important than most people think.
Sulfuric acid, specifically, it's the biggest bulk chemical on the planet. It's like, it doesn't get more bulk than this. We make more sulfuric acid than basically any other type of material globally. And it is used in almost everything. So sulfur is really key.
This is Marco Kenema, the Global Business Director for Oxidation Catalysts at BASF in Shanghai. While the word sulfur is not in his job description, he deals with the element a lot. Later in this episode, he'll tell us more about how BASF has revolutionized the production of sulfuric acids. But my first guest is Andrew Shidlow, a chemist slash entertainer who will take us on a wild ride through the sulfur world.
My name is Andrew Shidlow. I have a PhD in the history and philosophy of science, but my job is a chemistry teacher. I've been teaching chemistry now for 53 years.
Andrew's passion for chemistry started at a very young age.
Well, I suppose it was, I was probably about 8 years old. My parents gave me a chemistry set, and I just found mixing the ingredients together was fascinating. And I think at the age of 9 or 10, I was able to make my first ever spontaneous ignition using glycerine and potassium permanganate. And I think that really was the beginning of my great interest in chemistry, my own ability to achieve something which I saw the market as spontaneous. Spontaneous combustion. I can't remember exactly where it would have been, probably in the kitchen. That also didn't go down very well because it filled the kitchen with smoke. And my mother said, never, ever again will you do experiments at home. So I started doing them outside in the open air.
Andrew's love for making fire is what got him into chemistry in the first place. And that's why sulfur is just the element for him.
A lump of sulfur is a piece of yellow. It's a yellow solid. It's like a yellow Lego brick. You know, it's sort of, it's got that sort of color. It's quite brittle and it has no smell and it has no effect on your hand at all. But solid sulfur is quite an innocuous substance. It's quite innocuous until you set fire to it. And then it burns with a blue flame, a quiet blue flame, emitting the most obnoxious fumes you can imagine.
A yellow stone that can burn. Wow. It's kind of no wonder that people saw sulfur as something with the potential to transform the world. And about 1300 years ago, the first breakthrough happened. Beginning in China, people started combining sulfur with potassium nitrate and charcoal to make gunpowder.
And sulfur played a key role because it's much more easy to ignite. And it burns rapidly. No one really knows the exact way in which gunpowder burns. No one is able to write a chemical equation for the combustion of gunpowder. You can write speculative equations, but it depends on a huge number of circumstances. The fact remains unaltered that the discovery of gunpowder and the role of gunpowder in the history of the human race is undisputed.
That gunpowder smell, the same one you get from burning matches, that's the sulfur. sulfur dioxide to be precise. It doesn't smell great to some people, but it's nothing compared to hydrogen sulfide, a molecule made up of hydrogen and sulfur atoms, and it reeks like rotten eggs. Our noses are remarkably sensitive to this stinky substance, and that's because being able to smell minute quantities of it is a matter of life and death.
We humans can detect hydrogen sulfide in literally a few parts per million. Now, hydrogen sulfide is an extremely toxic gas. It affects the central nervous system. It replaces the role of oxygen in the body. So it stifles the body of oxygen in a similar way to carbon monoxide. But hydrogen sulfide is very, very toxic. And it deadens the nerves as well. So if you smell an amount of hydrogen sulfide, which is too much for the body to tolerate, then you go to a stage where you can't smell it any longer.
Hydrogen sulfide is also the main component in stink bombs. But the quantities are so low that nobody ever considered them to be dangerous. Just very, very mischievous, as Andrew knows from firsthand experience.
I think I must have dropped a few files of stink bombs. I suspect in the classroom when the teacher wasn't looking. And then the object of that was to make sure that the class would be evacuated and it would disrupt the lesson. And it was very difficult for the teacher to find out who dropped this file of ammonium sulfate. It was called a stink bomb, of course. But you mustn't tell anyone. I was quite a naughty boy at school, so I prefer not to dwell on that topic for too long.
Let's not dwell on that, because Andrew had an even better anecdote about sulfur to share. And this one goes back over 1,000 years ago to the age of alchemists. You know, the people who were obsessed with trying to turn lead into gold. In the 8th century, alchemists developed the sulfur-mercury theory of metals. In short, they believed that all metals, including gold, are made up of different ratios of yellow, solid sulfur, and liquid silver mercury. Now, this sounds silly to our modern day ears, but it was a perfectly plausible theory at the time.
People in those days, in the, let's say 1,000, 1,200 years ago, they used to think differently, a world of correspondences. If something looks like something, then that means it might be that thing. And because mercury is a silver liquid, dense liquid, sulfur a yellow solid, they reason that it is possible that in the bowels of the earth, sulfur and mercury combined in some ways, and volcanoes were living evidence of the bowels of the earth, to somehow make all other metals in various proportions.
The sulfur-mercury theory lasted for about 1,000 years, all the way to the 17th century. Today, we know that it is totally wrong. But since then, we've found many, many other uses for sulfur. Sulfur is the 5th most common element on Earth. With a few chemical reactions, you can turn elemental sulfur into sulfuric acid, which is one of the most important chemicals that we have. You'd be very hard-pressed to spend a single day without using a product that contains sulfuric acid, even though you might not realize it. For instance, have you driven in a car today? Well, it wouldn't have been possible without sulfuric acid for 2 very distinct reasons. Let's start with the first one.
Very few people today know what a car battery looks like, but I do because I've been interested and I actually repair my own cars and I actually teach automobile engineering. Today's batteries, which we have in cars, the technical term, it's called a lead acid accumulator. The lead acid accumulator is one of the greatest discoveries of the middle 19th century. The lead acid battery, which contains obviously lead and acid, but the acid it contains is sulfuric acid, a 30% solution, which is quite a corrosive, quite a high concentration of sulfuric acid. That is the acid which is used in lead acid batteries.
And the battery is not the only car part that relies on sulfuric acid. There's also the tires.
And of course, everyone takes tires for granted. They're made of rubber, and when they wear out, you throw them away. But it is a very extraordinary achievement that we have been able to invent a way of using rubber, which is a flexible material, an elastic substance, and to make it hard wearing. And that, of course, great discovery was the discovery of vulcanization. which involved sulfur.
So while you can't turn sulfur and mercury into gold, you absolutely need sulfur for car batteries, rubber tires, and lots of other products. Let's hear from Marco Kenema from BASF again.
The first one, which is probably the most obvious, is the food you eat. Sulfuric acid is key in the production of phosphoric acid. So basically any type of phosphate fertilizer. And you also have sulfates that you also include in fertilizer. So there's two key components in fertilizer for farmers that require sulfuric acid. Another area that's really important is detergents. The place where you probably can see it the easiest is on the back of any kind of shampoo. You'll see something like an alkyl sulfate or something like that. And those are really the key things that are cleaning your products. So cleaning your hair, cleaning your hands, basically. Cosmetics is probably where people would come in contact with products from sulfuric acid the closest.
Besides fertilizer and cleaning products, sulfuric acid is also a key component in the mining and processing of metals like copper, zinc, and nickel. You need sulfuric acid to produce semiconductor chips and to refine crude oil into high-quality gasoline. This broad range of applications makes it clear why sulfuric acid is the most produced chemical worldwide, with an annual market size of roughly 300 million tons. To turn elemental sulfur into this versatile sulfuric acid is a multi-step process.
When you talk about the production of sulfuric acid, you typically would start with sulfur dioxide, so sulfur with two oxygens. That's really the easy thing to make. You just burn sulfur and then you make SO2. And then what we want to do with that in order to make sulfuric acid is you want to add one more oxygen. So you want to go from sulfur with two oxygens to sulfur with three oxygens. And basically for that, you're going to need a catalyst. So the amount of energy it takes to go from sulfur with two oxygens to sulfur with three oxygens is pretty substantial. And then with the catalyst, you reduce that energy and you can do it at a reasonable temperature.
Once you have the sulfur trioxide, it's really easy to turn it into sulfuric acid. Essentially, you just add water. To make this reaction run safely, chemists these days do it in two steps. But those details don't really concern us today. What you need to know is that attaching that third oxygen atom to the sulfur dioxide, that's what takes the most energy. Without a catalyst, you would need to heat up a reactor to several hundred degrees Celsius higher than we do when we do use a catalyst. So over 100 years ago, chemists got to work figuring this out. And after some trial and error, they invented a catalyst that enabled this important reaction at much lower temperatures. That catalyst is called vanadium pentoxide.
The chemists 100 years ago were also extremely smart, and they knew how to test these different types of materials and understood the periodic table in a lot of detail. And that's where they really came out with this. It's not even only a vanadium, it's a vanadium with five oxygens, which is a very, very strong oxidizing agent. So it's very good at putting oxygen on other things or on other atoms. And that's really where, once you have a development like that, sometimes you do hit that point where you're not going to reinvent the wheel.
Here's a short recap just to make sure we're on the same page. Vanadium pentoxide helps add one oxygen to the sulfur dioxide to produce sulfur trioxide. But like any catalyst, vanadium pentoxide is not actually consumed during this reaction. It stays the same, and so it can be used multiple times. Still today, vanadium pentoxide is the catalyst of choice for this reaction. But people like Marco Kenema always believed that it could be improved. One area that BASF started experimenting with was the shape of the catalyst.
So in the early catalysts, they were actually just cylinders, very small cylinders. Then they developed into rings. So you would just have basically the cylinder with a hole in the middle. After that, we developed the star ring type catalysts. And now if you look at all of the companies that are in the market, it's all very similar to have a star type catalyst. So star ring, so you have a star shape with a hole in the middle.
These star ring catalysts are about 4 centimeters long and look kind of like churros, those Spanish deep-fried dough sticks that are so tasty when you dip them into hot chocolate. And that's not the only improved catalyst that they've been developing.
And then really in the last 7-8 years, BASF developed the Quattro catalyst. The first commercial reference for that was in 2016. And then we really commercially launched the product in 2019. So, and that was really probably the biggest development in the last little while.
Quattro catalysts get their name from the fact that they have not one, but 4 holes inside their cylindrical shape. This increases the surface area of the catalyst and further improves that conversion of sulfur dioxide to trioxide.
When you have these types of reactions, so for example, in a sulfuric acid unit, typical material is stainless steel, and the maximum temperature that a stainless steel unit can reach is around 630 degrees Celsius before the stainless steel starts to become damaged. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to reduce the temperature of the gas coming into the reactor. So with Quattro, we can run the reactor at a lower temperature because we have more surface to ignite the catalyst. So basically, you can keep the catalyst running at a lower temperature and still get conversion, which means you can start the reaction lower at a lower temperature and have a higher conversion throughout the reaction.
Quattro significantly lowers the reaction temperature, which conserves energy. Another advantage of that increased surface area is it helps to convert every last molecule of sulfur dioxide, so nothing is wasted. And lastly, the lifespan of the Quattro catalysts is significantly longer than the star ring ones.
With Quattro, you have nice smooth edges, so even if they're rubbing against each other, you're not losing surface area. You're always going to have a similar amount of surface area in the reactor, and you also have less dust formation. And that basically means that the customer can run for a longer time, so they don't have to change the catalyst as frequently.
Hold on. Change a catalyst? I mean, why would I ever need to change it if it isn't actually consumed during the reaction? If this also confused you, don't worry, we've got you covered. But let's first consider what a modern-day sulfuric acid production plant looks like.
You can be talking about units where they have production capacities of 5,000 tons per day of sulfuric acid. So then you're talking about a reactor that has a diameter of 15 meters, so very huge units. And again, same thing, it's just these catalyst pellets are just laid out over the entire reactor, in some cases up to a meter thick. And then you have the reaction taking place when the gas is blown through that reactor bed. And that's kind of what you can think about it in terms of day to day.
Marco Kenema compares the catalyst beds to an air filter that you can find in your car or air conditioning unit. When that filter is clean, it's easy to push gas through the air filter. But as the filter gets plugged with dust and dirt, this gets harder and harder. And the same applies to the catalyst. At the beginning, it takes very little energy to push the sulfur dioxide through the catalyst. But as the particles rub against each other, they create dust, and that, among other things, clogs up the pores. Now you either need more energy to push your gas through the catalyst bed, or your performance drops. So you might want to swap out your catalyst for a fresh new one. Now, the Quattro catalyst performed better than all the other catalysts before it. It had a larger active surface area, higher strength, a longer lifespan, and hence a 20 to 30% performance advantage compared to other standard sulfuric acid catalysts. But was Quattro the limit? It certainly seemed to be, at least if you stick to the traditional way of producing catalysts, which Marco described to me.
So basically, when you make pasta, you need to push it through some kind of dye to get the shape of the pasta. So when you make a catalyst, that's basically you're doing the same thing. So it's like making pasta, but you have a very different material.
But it's not set in stone that catalysts have to be produced this way. Why not use a 3D printer to make them? This is how the X3D catalysts were born.
So if you think about when you 3D print at home using your normal 3D printer, basically what you do is you melt plastic and then you do the same thing. You extrude it in a specific position and you have this melted plastic coming through a nozzle. That's the same concept that we do. It's just we're using different materials. So it's your standard 3D printing, just very different materials are used.
The new 3D printed catalyst was called X3D. Now, each catalyst unit is a bit bigger than a quarter coin, and they look somewhat like breakfast cereal. Marco Kenema and his team did their best to figure out the optimal shape of the catalyst, but this is no easy feat because catalytic chemistry is immensely complicated.
The case for the sulfuric acid catalyst, the actual catalyst activity, it's a liquid. It's a supported liquid. So under reaction conditions, the active phase is actually a melt. So I analyze a crystal under room temperature conditions, but when the catalyst is actually doing what it does, it's a melt. So it's a super complex process, and you're trying to use your knowledge of chemistry to understand what's going on under reaction conditions, and also very complex analytical chemistry to try and figure out if you can test under reaction conditions.
Because it's so difficult to figure out if a newly shaped catalyst will be better or worse, Marco didn't see much point in wasting hours and hours of ever more sophisticated tests. Instead, he just wanted to see how this catalyst performed in real life.
And honestly, that's basically the reason why instead of going through hundreds of testing experiments with the X3D catalyst, we went straight to a BASF plant and said, hey, we can make 500 to 600 kilograms of this material, even though at the time everyone in the lab thought we were crazy. And we said, we'll put it in a reactor and we'll see what the performance is. And the worst thing that could have happened was that it had the same performance as Quattro. And in the end, we saw much better performance, which then we had an idea we were in the right direction. And I think that's also the fun part is until we actually started up the plant, I didn't really know what was going to happen. I mean, I had ideas and all of the theory was saying that it was going to do what it was supposed to do. But until you actually see the data in the plant and you see that the catalyst is active at a really low temperature, below 350 degrees Celsius, you don't really know.
The X3D catalyst delivered. It outperformed the Quattro in many metrics. That innovative shape led to a higher reactor throughput, substantially lower energy consumption, and a longer lifespan of the catalyst itself.
And when we think about it from a catalyst manufacturing point of view, this is actually the worst case scenario for me because I make money when the customer changes their catalyst. But this catalyst might be so good that the customer doesn't need to change it. So it's not really in my interest to have this work from a company point of view. But in the end, from a performance point of view and from challenging the status quo, this is really the next level. And it really brings a significant advantage to our customers. And I think that's also a topic where at the beginning, there were a lot of people that didn't think this would ever work. And my response was always, if it makes money for my customers, it's only a matter of time. Because in the end, everyone's trying to make materials at a better price, improve their profit, and get to a position where they can beat competition. And this is one of those step changes where the people who adopt it at the beginning really will have a significant advantage over people who come later on in the game.
Because the chemical composition of the X3D catalysts is identical to the Star Ring or Quattro catalysts, people who want to switch catalysts have a pretty easy time doing so. They can simply swap out the old catalyst and fill in X3D.
This was really also one of the key reasons why we went for the technology that we have, because the barrier to enter to bring this product to market is going to be significantly lower than if I would come up with a completely new material. I mean, it's still always a risk for a customer. They always think that it's a risk. We try and mitigate that by knowing what we can do and making sure that our technical offers give them some peace of mind. But in the end, this is a solution that works. It's tested. It's been proven.
In the past, BASF wasn't able to produce large quantities of X3D catalysts. But now they can. And Marco Kenema expects that soon, sulfuric acid producers will be willing and ready to try this new catalyst out on an industrial scale.
Honestly, if you would have talked to most researchers in BASF in 2015 and asked them if we would have a commercial production line for 3D printing sulfuric acid catalysts in 2026, I think they would have all laughed at you. So I always say that great innovations come from crazy ideas. And I think you need people who are willing to take that risk with a bit of a financial eye to see that it actually makes sense for the customer. And I think that's really the key when you go into an industrial situation as a researcher. You need to be thinking about something which is going to help your customer. And I think that's something which is key at BASF that we really focus on a lot, is we're always trying to make an innovation that's going to help our customer make more money. And if you can do that, there's no limit to what the customer will try, because if it gives them an opportunity that they can be more successful, that's really the target that we all have.
That's it for our episode about sulfur today. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll come back for our next one, all about clay. This has been Substance, stories about the stuff that shapes our world. Substance is a podcast by BASF, produced by Territory Agency, in collaboration with Wake Word and me, Joe Hansen. Research and scripting by Danielle Sedbrook, Claudia Doyle, Hardy Röder, and Joe Hansen.